This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Three-pointer.
Oh, Huggins! Double honor!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
Oh! LeBron James with no regard for human life!
Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Madden. What are you still doing here?
Here's Matt Yoder.
They are voted by Awful Announcing readers as having the best podcast, best studio show, best social media account, and the best entertainers in all the sports media in the last year. They are the greatest British export since the Spice Girls. We are pleased to welcome, live from the crap part of Soho, it is Roger Bennett and Michael Davies, the one and only Men in Blazers. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you for having us on. We believe that your listeners are just very, very sympathetic to bald people.
Well, that's very, very true, Roger. You know, I don't think a lot of people realize, you know, I'm not a front-facing person as a blogger, but I'll join you in that category here. Give me 2 or 3 years, and I'll probably be there. But I think there's a great spiritual connection, though, between a site like Awful Announcing and a suboptimal duo like yourselves. I feel like our mission statements just align so well with one another.
Yeah, absolutely. Although your announcing is nowhere near as awful as our broadcasting is not optimal. Yeah, your awful part is ironic. Yeah.
We've got a lot to strive to then. So first off, you guys have told the story several times over how you got together at a wedding during the 06 World Cup final. If nobody has heard the backstory, Google it, it's out there. It's great. But following that, you know, people pair up all the time, but becoming a success as a duo is something else entirely. What has been the biggest factor in the two of you becoming such a successful partnership? Is it the chemistry that you hit it off right away? Is it your approach to the job? How you view soccer? How has this worked out so well and why?
I just think that Roger and I, you know, it was inevitable when we met. It's like heart to heart. When they met, it was moida. It's like when we met, it was inevitable that we were going to be friends.
Apart from Devo, it's both Jonathan and Jennifer Hart. I'm Max, and I take care of them both with Jane Easy. Because when they met, it was Moida. And Max and Freeway.
In the Freeway, yeah. We get on, we're mates, we're friends. And so what you really, if we weren't doing a podcast, if we weren't doing Men in Blazers, Roger and I have often said we'd be down at the pub talking about it anyway and hanging out and making each other laugh. We have so many, I mean, we've got to start recording our pre-podcast. Yesterday, we just went back and we talked about our school experiences, about our dads, about 1980s music. We just talk. We spend a lot of time talking about things not on the air, but it's just like our podcast because we just have a lot in common growing up at a similar time, but in very different parts of Britain and from, in some ways, quite different backgrounds.
How did you two become this enormously successful worldwide phenomenon, television, social media, the web? I mean, maybe there is that element where it's just two guys who get along, who enjoy their football and enjoy having a laugh with one another. But is there something more beyond that, or is it just that simple that has led you guys to resonate with so many people?
I think you're confusing it with Robbie Musto and Robbie Earle. When you think of the word global phenomenon of football in the same sentence, I think at the core of it is partly we're very, very passionate about a lot of things. Anything that we talk about, I think passion is at the core. And I think the United States is currently going through a remarkable moment in regards to the sport where the embrace of football is absolutely total, and the audience who are falling in love with it and the coverage on NBC every morning, it's like Saturday morning cartoons led by Rebecca Lowe, the two Robbies, Kyle Martino, the narrative that they're engaged in, which is ultimately that what we play our trade in, that the thrilling narrative of the Premier League is really just entrancing a generation of Americans who've come of age with the sport, with EA Sports FIFA, playing it, getting to know all the different characters. And I think to a large degree, we're just beneficiaries of good timing. And the fact that you allow bald men on television in America, which we don't in England, which is why we're here. We're definitely riding the wave. But I also think that there are these sort of two other weird things that go on with us. One is that we're half very, very serious about what we're doing. And our our commitment to doing Men in Blazers with each other, first of all, you know, in on radio and the podcast, and as we built up the blog and the social media, and now the TV show at NBC, SN, the live shows, we've been really committed to it, and yet it's always, to some extent, had that sort of fun and passion of being a hobby before it was really successful. And I think doing something which you take seriously, but at the same time is just having fun with each other, is really important. And then I also think the combination of the, you know, sheer amateurism and suboptimal nature of what we do, but also, you know, we're fortunate enough, because of the understanding of my employers at Sony, we've got Embassy Row, we've got a major production company behind us, which has allowed us to figure out ways of making our content and recording our content and getting it out there. And, you know, between Roger's, you know, past as a writer and documentary filmmaker that's built amazing relationships with, you know, people from all spheres of football, players, managers, administrators, journalists in the world of football, and then my connections within the TV business and the entertainment business, entertainment circles, it's meant we've been able to sort of bring that wealth of experience to something which is our shoddy amateur operation at the same time. And it's that combination, the yin and the yang of that, which is sort of rare, I think.
This week, this season, it was best captured. There was a week in which we launched a special pod extra, which was a 30-minute conversation with Ian Robin of Bayern Munich, the great Dutch master, one of the top five players in the world of football at the moment, came on, did a 30-minute conversation about his style of unique style of play.
His dodgy flapper,
the fact that everyone knows what he's going to do in football, which is cut in from the left and then shoot, but no one can stop him. And we talked about it at length. So in one minute, we had Bayern Munich supply one of their best players of the past couple of seasons. The next day, we did an in-depth conversation with an 11-year-old Manchester United fan who captured America's hearts with his amateur
Charlie, the Red.
I mean, the most remarkable 11-year-old. How passionate the 11! Yeah. They played like 11 best friends. And to go from kind of the high culture tactical talk of Ian Robin to this wonderful young kind of English fan and bring them both back to back, that's really the juxtaposition of the universe that we are immersed in.
And I think that's the amazing thing about what you guys have done, is because you are so accomplished in other walks of life, and now this podcast and now TV show has sort of risen to that level. Was there a moment when it hit you, Roger and Michael, just how big this has become with the Men in Blazers? Was it one of the live shows, a late night appearance, something in between? Was there one of those instances where you looked at each other and thought, I can't believe we've taken this hobby, this passion, and have it reach this level?
No, I mean, to be candid, Dave and I fixate on one thing and one thing only, other than the conversation between ourselves, which we'd be having irrespective of Men in Blazers or not, and that is the relationship with our listeners. And so the thing that we really work hard at and invest a huge amount of emotional energy and time in is the social media, the ravens, the emails that we receive at meninblazers@gmail.com, the Facebook, the Instagram now. And we really, it's a three-way conversation that we work on. And that's what's built this American fan base who are adoring football, who are living and dying with the different Premier League teams and the U.S. men's national team and the U.S. women's national team that they really are becoming amazingly devoted to. And really, the only thing we really think about, it's not the appearances or it's our engagement with them, our interactions with them, the amazing ideas they have, the amazing feedback they have, the amazing Photoshops that they create. And that's what's grown. The noise from that has grown and grown and grown. And that's what fills us with wonder and that we never take for granted.
I suppose also that there were three very big moments for us that all happened, you know, around sort of 10, 11, 12 months ago for us. I think that, you know, Grantland giving us the opportunity to make video for the first time. And we'd done something years and years ago around the rugby for BBC America. But really, when we did these sort of YouTube World Cup previews with Grantland, it was the first time we really took our brand off just the podcast and we'd made video. And what that led to was us, you know, Skipper, got to see that, John Skipper got to see that, and then that led to us getting the opportunity to go and do the World Cup in person from Brazil.
You can't even remember where it was.
Yeah. we mainly were in a closet. I do have goldfish riff on my head right now, which will be apparent when you see our final show this Sunday. And then I think the decision by ESPN to put us in a closet was a master stroke that was not necessarily them trying to do us a favour, but we ended up in a closet at the World Cup, and we won, you know, as I think BuzzFeed read, we won the World Cup from a closet. Is that that was almost, I think we were devastated when we first saw where we were going to be broadcasting from, but it ended up being the best thing possible for us.
Once you'd removed the tape from our mouth.
Yeah, and then of course that got the attention, and then, you know, NBC made the deal with us, you know, when we came back. So a lot happened for us in a period last year. Having said that, I have to hand it to my partner, Roger, is that, you know, he was always, you know, Roger used to say to me 2 years ago, I'm not sure I've ever admitted this to you, Roger, but Roger used to say to me, so like, how are we doing? What are we going to do? What's our plan to go and get a TV show? And in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, Roger, we're never going to have a TV show. Like, we're just the Men in Blazers. Like, we're not going to be on TV. That's never going to happen. I'm a TV professional. I know about developing and selling TV shows. That's not going to happen. And then I always used to put him off by saying, oh, but the World Cup will be our moment. The World Cup will be our moment. I'm not sure I really believe that when I said it, but it did end up being our moment. And that ended up how we ended up remarkably having a TV show every week.
You're wrapping up the first year at NBC, the first year of that Men in Blazers TV show. Take us back then to last summer. You're coming off that success at the World Cup, the best thing that's probably ever happened to anyone who was stuffed in a closet. And now you're faced with this decision to stick with ESPN or move to NBC. Was it the creation of the TV show? Was it something else that was so attractive about NBC that caused you to make that jump after such a successful spell at ESPN with the Grantland partnership and also with the television aspect there at the World Cup?
You know, look, it was a really, really difficult decision to, and we were faced with a very high-class problem as we had three really good offers from all the three major stakeholders in soccer in the US. And, you know, ultimately, by the time every network had sort of, you know, got through their, you know, initial offers and realized what the market was, that, you know, the deals they were offering were all very, very similar. And it was a difficult decision. And I had a feeling, you know, as, you know, great as NBC have been, I also have a great respect for what ESPN do with soccer and what Fox have done for soccer in this country. And I think probably we could have made it work anywhere. But the adjacency to the Premier League, as we've said before, became the big deciding factor. And the talent that was already at NBC, who we just, you know, not only respected so much, but, like, they were our mates. Like, we really, really liked them. And they liked us. And we knew that we needed to be in a place where we could be very different than the rest of the production on air. We needed to be counter to it. But at the same time, we needed to have really good relationships with the people there.
It's been a, I mean, the Premier League is our narrative. It's a narrative that we live, the narrative that we breathe. Premier League football is the one thing in life that makes us experience human emotions as a normal people. Happiness, sadness, the joy of victory, the excruciating pain of defeat. Most normal people feel them just in their regular life. David and I are both numb to those feelings. And it's not watching Premier League football that we feel truly alive. So the fact that NBC had the rights was that's our holy grail. That's our urtext. So to be adjacent to that was that. I mean, we are Premier League creatures, and we crave to be where the Premier League rights are. And so that's it. But we also dreamt always. They always say every team has a weak link, and we dreamt of being NBC's weak link. I think we fulfilled that promise and then some. And also, for me, to be able to make documentaries during the season, to go over to England on a regular basis and to kind of step in, a bit like David Attenborough making movies with Mongolian gazelles and bringing them back. That's something I really wanted to do and want to do more and more and more. And the opportunity to do that at NBC has been an absolute joy.
Yeah, and they're going to let me in one of the Spartan races too.
If the goal is really to be the weak link at NBC, though, I mean, it seems to me the next step is like a primetime network sitcom. If we've seen how NBC has gotten along after The Office and 30 Rock and Parks and Rec have gone away, a Men in Blazers sitcom special. I think that has a lot of potential to be the most craptastic, amazing, suboptimal network prime time show. If there's anyone that can make it happen. All right, let's focus in on the television show because it is really so unique, so much fun. And Michael, I remember the quote that you gave to Dan Patrick earlier this year about seeing two of the great things in life in football, or soccer, as it will, and that is crap and also hilarity. So how is it that you go about finding all of the footage, all of the hilarious crap that happens in the Premier League to highlight on a weekly basis?
Well, I mean, look, I'm not in any way going to belittle the amount of research and the amount of work that our wonderful producer, JW, and our wonderful team, and frankly, the work that our GFOPs do, sending us suggestions, and the work that Rush does, pouring over hours and hours and hours of Premier League footage every week. But I would say that the Premier League offers us gift after gift after gift after gift. Just the managers alone, forget about the gameplay, forget about the players. The managers this season in the Premier League have almost without exception given us moment after moment after moment of insanity. Louis van Gaal, like, we didn't even have a chance yet to cover his speech last night at the Man United dinner, which was just insane, Louis van Gaal.
We could do an hour-long special just decoding, deconstructing the speech he gave at the club end-of-season awards last night.
Yeah.
He's a very giving gentleman. I mean, Jose Mourinho's return over the last 2 years has been incredibly nourishing from a narrative perspective. Manchester City's dreadful defence of their title is amazing. Liverpool, their team built on dreams and nostalgia.
And the
cult of Brendan Rodgers, which has one cult member, Brendan Rodgers. and Gerrard's very human kind of goodbye, almost like an Arthur Miller character who wants his name back. The Premier League gives unbelievably well. We have a tiny team. We have a tiny, tiny, tiny staff. I mean, we can barely afford post-its in this production. Mm-hmm. But it's a very passionate staff. We had a guest on the show who is a very successful and unbelievably skilled and remarkable gentleman with his own show where he does news highlights. I won't mention who it is, but he came in and we were comparing our processes. He saw that I was just writing on my own at the table. He's like, "Where's your writer's room?" I was like, "You're looking at it." I was like, how many staff do you have? And he said, "Well, to start with, I have 14 video editors." And I was just like, "Oh, my God. Oh, man. I'd settle for one. If we had one video editor, video researcher, it would be an unbelievable upgrade." But it's a very, I'd say, a very lean production staff. We have JW, who's an amazing producer, who does, so much work. We have Lexi, worked with him, and Jen Simons, our producer, and that's it. Everything else is Dave and myself. And the fact that the Premier League is so awash in narrative makes the job easier than it would seem, but at the weekend it is absolutely all hands on deck, and as the season grinds to a halt, to have a couple of weeks with an actual weekend in it is going to be a thing of wonder.
Which Premier League personality, player or manager, gives you to the most to work with on a regular basis? Is it Van Gaal? Is it Mourinho? Is it a player? Who is it that gives you the most to work from in life's rich tapestry?
Well, I think Van Gaal and Mourinho are definitely almost equal. Very, very different guys, but you almost cannot. I think they also understand their mission to entertain. I mean, and to get headlines. They are so knowing when they speak in front of the media. None of this is accidental, and they give us like just fantastic material. I think to some extent they want to be larger than their. They want to take the pressure off their players by being sort of larger than their teams. And then look, I think the other unique aspect of the Premier League, you know, versus American sports, is just the concept is how many trophies and titles are being paid for. You know, there's the championship, there's Champions League qualification, there's Europa League qualification, there's relegation, there's so much at stake all the time. So I think just the nature of the Premier League gives us a lot to work with.
I am starting to think the past couple of weeks, to be honest, Louis van Gaal, the Manchester United manager, I'm starting to think he's actually purposefully doing things. I wouldn't be so arrogant as to think he wants bandwidth on our show. Because some of the things he's doing at the end of the season at Old Trafford, the last game at Old Trafford, to see him walk towards the fans with a microphone in his hand, I knew the second I saw him take steps towards the Old Trafford faithful, something very, very special was about to occur. And just the 90-second speech, which we said on the show, is part Mussolini, part Roseanne Barr singing the national anthem. You couldn't script, and it ended with him saying he didn't know what to say. The fans didn't stop singing. He thought they'd go silent to feed on his golden nuggets. They just wanted to sing, and they kept chanting. So he felt a bit awkward. He was kind of left hanging. So he just barked into the microphone, "We will see each other next year." And then he took three beats, and then he just screamed in an incredible key. No one does that unless they want
to
make.
He almost needed to be He almost needed to be stroking a white cat at that point, like a James Bond villain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another big moment that has obviously given you a lot of material: Stevie G's Anfield farewell, his career coming to an end. How Stevie fitting!
Well, that's no way to speak about an MLS. Don Garber won't like that.
We'll get to that in a moment. First, his Premier League career coming to an end. How fitting was that whole scene with the guard of honor, everything happening, and then finally the air is let out of the balloon. They fall to Palace 3-1, just as a symbol of his career as this great giant figure in the game, and yet there's always that mark of him in the Premier League, the plight not winning a title for Liverpool. Did that game just so perfectly capture his legacy at Liverpool, or are we being too hard on Gerrard here at the end and not giving him credit for Istanbul and all the FA Cup and League Cup wins and what he has done over the totality of his career?
Well, first of all, we've got to say is that I've been watching English football for like 44, 45 years. I've never seen as many guards of honour as we've seen over the last like 2 weeks in the Premier League. I don't really remember many guards of honour, but this has been insane. Look, I think that time will tell on the legacy of Steven Gerrard, whether it's going to be Istanbul or some of the amazing games he's played, or if he gets the true credit for being the genuine box-to-box midfielder that he really is. I mean, Lampard and Scholes were amazing contemporaries of his, but neither of them, they were both goal scorers, neither of them could tackle and defend in the way that Gerrard could. And it's amazing. I'm not sure that we're going to see another player like him ever. Homegrown, fan of the club, playing so many years and so successfully in so many positions for his club. So, yes, I think we are being hard on him, but I have a feeling that the legacy in time will look a little bit better.
We said on the podcast that his career has become like Captain Ahab and the Premier League title was his Moby Dick. And it's fascinating because many American football fans are more recent to the game post-2010 World Cup, a large percentage of them. And the sadness of Stevie Gerrard as he faces the American market is a huge number of American football fans, soccer fans, never saw the Stevie G of 2009 and before when he was just magnificent. It's like seeing Warren Beatty now. You can't imagine that this guy was once one of the great Hollywood romancers. And just an incredible romantic figure. Only seeing him now as this tragic Stevie G, Stevie G of the slip, Stevie G of the 38-second sending off, Stevie G of the team that never won the title, where they said goodbye to him at Anfield, the PA guy on the public announcer system said that he's won almost everything there is in the game to win, is how they carefully broached the fact that he didn't win a Premier League title. He was magnificent. He is a magnificent footballer. He's had a magnificent footballing career. To stay with one club, a club built on passion and dreams and nostalgia like Liverpool for that long, it's a remarkable human achievement. Sadly for him, he came so close to his dream, his Moby Dick, the Premier League title. Tragically, it was his slip, arguably, that let it slip away right at the end of one of the most dramatic Premier League seasons. But to be clear, he was a phenomenal footballer, and it's going to be fascinating to see Stevie G, this Liverpool gentleman that's lived all his life in the northwest of England, adjust to California. If I were NBC, that's the show I'd actually want to turn into a reality show.
Yeah, and the hole he leaves at Liverpool, like, I think that, you know, not only as a player...
It's going to be Steve Bruce-sized.
There's no... like, he has been the talismanic player for the last 17 years at a club that has always had talisman. There is no talisman left at Liverpool, and it's going to leave a giant hole in that club.
And just personally, I mean, Steven Gerrard and what he did in 05 and 06, I mean, that as a fan got me into soccer with that Champions League final against AC Milan, with the 2006 FA Cup final. I mean, that goal against West Ham in the 90th minute. I mean, just personally, for me, that was what made me a soccer fan. And so luckily, I was able to get in on the ground floor before the sport really took off about 4 or 5 years later. So for me, coming into the sport and knowing what Gerrard had done, and then following his career for the last decade, just as this tragic hero of English football and everything that happened at Liverpool and how close he came and what happened with the national team, now to see him leave under these circumstances and go to the Galaxy at this point in his career, I mean, just in the richness of the narrative, I don't know if we'll see in quite some time a player, as you guys have said, that is homegrown, that is that box-to-box midfielder, that represents so much about his club and where he is. It just seems like when we're looking at Gerrard, he might be one of those last of an era type players.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think then the question becomes, what kind of a footballer is he going to be at, you know, the Galaxy and in an MLS? And I really don't know. I asked Rog genuinely during the podcast yesterday, like, what? How do you think he's actually going to do? Because I really have no idea. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see.
So who do you guys think will have the better MLS career? Stevie G or Frank Lampard? And will we ever actually see one of them suit up in MLS?
Yeah, I mean, I believe they're both coming to MLS. And I think that Frank Lampard is a more certain commodity at this point. We've seen him play, you know, really very well this season. We know he's still got tremendous fitness. You know, his body, Roger calls him the English muffin a lot. He's still in very, very good shape. And he's still, you know, the kind of player he is, he relies on that sort of intelligent ball. And, you know, he probably can't make those late breaks into the box and score the number of many goals that he used to. But I think within MLS, and I've seen NYCFC play quite a lot, I think he's going to be a massive, massive addition. And a sort of addition of quality to that team. A guy who's won a lot, that team needs more of a winning mentality. The Galaxy have had a lot of success. They play in a much warmer climate, which, having watched Gerrard play around the world in England over the summer, I'm a little worried about the climate.
We're worried he might melt.
You know, it's an unsure commodity. You know, I'm not quite sure that he's got the... if he's got that... agility, the mobility, the, you know, the speed, the leg strength. I'm not sure that he's got all of that still. But maybe that's been the weight of the world on his shoulders in Anfield. He hasn't liked being a bit player. He wants to be, you know, first name on the team sheet. And, you know, I think he probably can be that at the Galaxy.
Both of the gentlemen are remarkable professionals. And MLS is a fascinating league to enter. Not just because, these players are used to travelling first class. They're not going to be travelling first class. The different accoutrement culture of the training grounds will be interesting. How they react to the incredible distances they have to travel in between games routinely. But I remember when Thierry Henry arrived, and he came on Morning Joe the week he arrived. And the players always, some of them thrive in the anonymity that America provides. Tim Cahill loved playing in New York, to walk around without being recognised ever. I mean, he and his family really were nourished by that. But I remember Thierry Henry in his first week here, he enjoyed being an anonymous figure in New York, but he also didn't. He came to Morning Joe, and he came to the security guard as he walked in, goes, "Identification, please." And Thierry Henry looked at the security guard like, "How do you not know who I am? I'm Thierry bloody Henry." And, I mean, the security guard had no idea. I didn't even know who Arsenal were. He couldn't care less. And Jeremy, it was a shock to him that he was living in a place. Anonymity is great, but when you want to be recognised, people not knowing who you are, it takes the ego sometimes to adjust. Some players do, some players don't. And so we'll have to see how they both fit in. how they've both acculturate and how quickly they adapt to the peculiar rhythms, wonderfully peculiar rhythms of the league. But I wouldn't be surprised if they both make very serious contributions because they are both model professionals.
I think one thing's for sure, we will know MLS has made it as a worldwide league if there is a controversy over Gerrard and Lampard fitting into the same midfield of the MLS All-Stars. If they can play together there, then we'll know. We'll know MLS has finally made it. Since you guys do follow the EPL and Major League Soccer, we've seen MLS grow. We've seen them expand. Orlando City with Kaká, NYCFC with Lampard, David Villa. We see attendances up, but yet still that Moby Dick, I guess, for the league right now is the television ratings. And we see consistently the EPL outrage MLS by wide margins on a weekly basis. What can MLS do to break through on television and get caught up in this soccer wave that has seen such success for the World Cup and the Premier League and the Champions League and the like?
Look, I do think that... you know, and Roger and I speak about this all the time, that, you know, the progress that Major League Soccer has made since its inception to now, even, by the way, just over the last, in this century, has been absolutely phenomenal. And they never have got enough credit for that. But I think that has put the league in a slightly sort of defensive mindset in terms of how they view, you know, the rest of the soccer world and their standing versus the rest of the soccer world. And I think the one thing that I find sometimes missing from MLS, and by the way, I'm a season ticket holder now, and, you know, I really, really enjoy the product live in the stadium, but sometimes I find the coverage way, way, way too serious. And I think that there is an inherent humor and passion with the way that this game is covered in England particularly, but it also happens around the world, that is a little bit absent. The league so much wants to be taken seriously. Everything is so serious all of the time. I think the players feel quite controlled by the people who run publicity at the various, or run the communications departments at the various clubs. And I think the league has to really lighten up a little bit and stop taking itself too seriously in order to have a more serious television product which more people can go and enjoy.
All right, I know our time is running short. I want to ask you this question as experts in both British and American culture and British and American sport. You could have a Premier League star play any American sport, star for any team. Who would make that best crossover?
Okay, good question.
I would love Arsene Wenger to come over and make a player trade in the UFC cage. I only saw in his fight against Jose Mourinho that he may not have anymore what it takes to be a title-winning Premier League manager. But I promise you, if you got him into one of these major UFC bouts, he would probably be taking over trophies.
Wearing his puffer coat.
Just the tie flicks, just the sprint slaps, all the different moves that I've never really seen a man throw before. I think he completely befuddled a lot of the guys who train week in, week out. Yeah, finger in the UFC cage.
But I do think that Diego Costa would be amazing in the UFC also. I think there are a lot of UFC combatants. If there's one player I'd love to see come and play in the United States, just from a narrative point of view, to make the league more fun and more entertainment and the off-the-field colour, it would probably be Mario Balotelli. I think that would be an amazing MLS target. Maybe we could join Beckham's new team down in Miami when that happens. I think that would be a really good thing. If there's a Premier League athlete who could go and make it in, you know, one of the other major sports, yeah, I'd probably be a kicker. Crazy Joe Hart would be a pretty phenomenal NFL punter or kicker. Yeah, I'd like to see that.
If I was seriously running an MLS team, I would bring over Akin Fenwa, the Wimbledon striker, beast mode. Strongest man on EA Sports FIFA. We had him do a special pod. An amazing character. He's the kind of character that can create social media buzz off the field in a wonderful, warm his life story, which he told to our viewers, rated as a podcast in massive numbers. If I was running an MLS team, I would bring him over in all seriousness right now. And other than that, in American sports, what could an English-based athlete actually dominate? The only one that comes to mind would probably be Steve Bruce. If Hull go down, he could come over and become a competitive eater.
Steve Bruce versus Joey Chestnut. on the 4th of July. All right, season finale of Men and Blazers comes up this next week after the Premier League season is concluded. What should we expect to see?
Well, crap-tacular on Sunday night when Jeremy Roenick tells us we can be on after the hockey.
So is there any preview, any taste of the craptastic finale that you can give viewers on what to expect?
We can promise it's going to be unwatchable. it's going to be an hour long. It's going to be absolutely unwatchable. I can tell you, Rebecca Lowe is going to be our guest. So that segment you can watch. So you could pretend that she's hosting and we're her guests, and then it might be a celebrating prospect. Can we just say how phenomenal she is? And the work that she has done in developing the sport in this country. I mean, Robbie and Kyle have been phenomenal in terms of their consistency, the hard work they put in, their analysis, which I think is, consistently amazing. Arlo White, what a job he's done over there. I think of him just toiling around, hitchhiking from stadium to stadium with a little knapsack on his back as he goes over to commentate for us. And he has no idea how massive he is in America. He says he just finishes commentating and then clicks off, pulls off his microphone, and then finds himself like on the bus home. You know, in England, people are not mobbing Arlo White in the way they would if he turned up in America. But Rebecca Lowe, I think consistently, week in, week out, there are few. I mean, it's something you cover and you understand far better than we do. But I would imagine there are few individuals who've made an impact on a sport in terms of intelligent accessibility for our audience more than Rebecca.
And one thing that makes her work so well is her sense of humour. You know, mm-hmm. she has a brilliant improvisational comedy mind and background, actually.
In all seriousness, there is none much better than the Mother of Dragons. And really, in all seriousness, the entire team at NBC, we've said it from the beginning, it is one of the best in all of sports television. And the one element that you guys have added with the humor and the Men in Blazers being part of that, such a perfect complement to what has been built at NBC for the Premier League coverage. And I think I would speak for a lot of fans that would hope when the next rights cycle comes along to see this unit stick together and cover the Premier League for many years to come. All right, as we get out, what's next for Men in Blazers? Summer plans? How will you continue to grow the empire? Where can we find you once the Premier League season wraps up?
Wish we could tell you what we're about to do. We're going to be able to tell you in a couple of weeks what we're going to do this summer, but we're going on holiday together, and that holiday is going to be featured on television. But we'll be talking about that in a couple of weeks. We need a bit of a break from the Premier League, but we won't stop. The website, social media, the podcast, we'll keep on going. Just take a short break.
And when you say the word empire, never has an empire been used more facetiously than the British Empire, which is in about a similar state of disarray as ours. But thank you for having us on. We are grateful. And thank you for the support of all the awful announcing readers and listeners to this podcast for their support. It means a lot to us.
A National Lampoon's Raj and Devo spectacular just might break television and the internet and Twitter and everything. All right, our thanks to Michael Davies and Roger Bennett for joining us today. Follow them on Twitter individually at Embassy Davies and Raj Bennett, and collectively at Men and Blazers. Follow them on Instagram, Facebook, subscribe to The Raven, the podcast, everything in between as they span the globe towards world domination. Gentlemen, a pleasure. Thanks again, and hopefully we get to do this again sometime soon.
Thank you. Thank you so much.